hardly anyone writes about science fiction from the Republic of the Philippines. What accounts for this dearth of inquiry? Probably, science fiction is still largely seen by our local literati as a vehicle of escapism, as many literary scholars have asserted. Charles Stan links this to the fact that many modern works haven't really strayed from the formula of one of our first novels, José Rizal's No Limit Tangere, a statement that echoes Resil Mujares's claim that the novels of Rizal determined literary standards no Filipino writer can ignore. Such critics are intentionally or unintentionally segregating science fiction from the so-called socially relevant strain of fiction traced back to the works of José Rizal. By science fiction, by the way, I am referring to fiction with a characteristic cognitive estrangement effect that results from placing a fantastic, although scientifically conceivable object or objects in a setting reflective of our objective reality or in an alternative universe where the same laws of nature apply. This definition is derived from that of Darko Suvin, one of the more well-known theorists engaged in the study of science fiction. In this paper, I argue that Rizal, to some extent, implicitly disavows this mutual exclusivity of science fiction and socially relevant fiction, as his novel El Filibusterismo, while hardly a work of science fiction, properly speaking, contains elements that show how advanced science, even the fictive variety, can play a vital role in works that are often heralded as literary by our cultural elite, or more importantly, how science, genuinely existing or imaginary, can figure in literary works that have or can have transformative effects on our society. And to begin the discussion, I'll first go into a discussion of the El Filibusterismo's scientifically superior alien, Simon. It remains a mystery to me why illustrations of Simon share a number of glaring errors. From covers of recent editions of the Philly to what I have seen of that 1962 film starring Pancho Magalona, Simon either resembles a 19th century Anglo-Hispanic with a stovepipe hat or a Hispanic version of Gary Oldman in that Francis Ford Coppola Dracula film some 20 minutes into that movie. I have yet to come across an accurate graphic illustration of the Philly's main character, even though his outer attributes are vividly described in the first few pages of the novel. I gripe about this because, as many scholars have pointed out, Rizal painstakingly made sure that Simon, at the very least when he first appears, makes his mark on readers as an uncanny character. He's a foreign oddity. He's tall, he's thin, he has white hair, but he has a black beard. He wears a Tintin helmet, he has a strange, interminable accent, and he has these enormous azure eyeglasses that are up to his cheeks. Is he an American mulatto or a British Indian? Simon confides the answer to only a few of the Philly's characters. To most, for the majority of the novel, the man who goes by only one name, the obscenely wealthy jeweler, the confidant of the country's governor general, is an alien of indeterminate nationality, thus the purveyor of very strange beliefs. Now, the revelation of who Simon really is hardly comes as a surprise to anyone who has read the novel's predecessor. Simon is Crisostomo Ibarra, idealistic hero of the Noli, now in villainous costume. He is now Edmond Dantes turned into the Count of Monte Cristo with an anarchic twist. He sees himself as a sower of discord for a cause. He seeks to return the favor to those who wanted him dead for subversion, who believe that their wish was fulfilled. He desires death for those who greatly diminish the chances that he would live happily ever after with Maria Clara, who is now cloistered in a convent when he starts his campaign to foment chaos. His mission, in brief, is 1, cause a revolt fatal to the country's authoritarian elite. 2, resume relations with Maria Clara after liberating her from the nunnery. Now, Vicente Rafael is correct in emphasizing the role of money in Simon's mission. Simon's wealth is an instrument of his will, necessary to sow crime and incite popular uprisings to allow Simon to be the devil in human form. What Rafael fails to mention is that Simon's mastery of science also plays a crucial role in realizing his revenge. Science here refers to the systematized body of knowledge on occurrences and reality obtained empirically, that is, that which is derived from observation, preliminary data gathering, then finally hypothesis testing, which allows the construction of scientific theories or falsification thereof. This definition comes from my high school biology notes. An early manifestation of Simon's scientific superiority is the insinuation that he tells people that the reason why he wears those enormous eyeglasses is to shield his eyes from the light of the sun. Rizal, a locally celebrated ophthalmologist, may be in this instance prescribing an alternative use for eyewear that at the time typically functioned to hide the wearer's eyes. Wala pa nung sunglasses. It was only in early 20th century when tinted eyeglasses made specifically to shield the eyes from bright lights became popular. And then in chapter 10, Simon converses with Cabezan Tales about the tulisanes that abound in the barrios. Tales tells Simon that these bandits have firearms that shoot far. Simon then shows Tales that his revolver can also shoot far. He targets, thereafter accurately hits the nuts of a palmera de bonga some 200 pasos away, which, if pasos refers to the archaic unit of measurement corresponding to about 1.4 meters, that would mean that he shot accurately at a distance of around 300 meters, I guess, which is remarkable for a revolver that existed in the 1880s to the early 1890s. But these are some of the novel's lesser scientific wonders, so to speak. These are decidedly minor achievements when considered alongside the novel's more remarkable devices, which is the time bomb of sorts in the pomegranate lamp and the illusionist spirit summoning apparatus. We first consider the former. Simon's schemes culminate in a bomb plot, an assassination. Mass murder by means of exploding devices was by no means unheard of in the late 19th century. Simon's bomb, however, was indeed a novelty. It was made up of a vessel that resembles a pomegranate, large as the head of a man, cut slightly to show the inner grains, but of more interest over aesthetics is what is inside the lamp. Below the lamp's burner was a vessel of steel some 2 centimeters thick and capable of holding more than a liter of what we later learn is nitroglycerin. Later, Simon screwed tight an odd and complicated apparatus set in place the tube of crystal, the bomb, and crowned everything in a very elegant lampshade. As previously stated, the device is a time bomb of sorts. It is to be the primary source of light in a gathering of the city's elite. When it dims after 20 minutes, should someone raise the lamp's wick, a capsule of fulminate of mercury will detonate, and thus the pomegranate will explode. The bomb was made by a primary school teacher who Simon turned into a pyrotechnicist, perhaps taught him how to make this device. Benedict Anderson says that Simon's bomb plot is partly based on the bomb assassination of Tsar Alexander in 1881, the year before Rizal arrived in Europe for the first time. But he also says that imagined in 1890 to 1891, the bomb plot precedes rather than follows the spectacular wave of bomb outrages that rocked Spain and France in 1892 to 1894. More importantly, Anderson states that none of the bombs in the aforementioned events were anything like Simon's pomegranate. And with his ability to mentally conjure such a potentially efficient terroristic device, it is small wonder why many believe that Rizal himself was an anarchist. Indeed, Rizal was considerably talented in imagining the frightening. Besides the bomb, there is the device of Mr. Leeds. The device of Mr. Leeds is what I was referring to earlier as the spirit summoning apparatus, which is the illusionist's talking head table. You might recall this in the chapter entitled Deceptions in English Translation. Benedict Anderson, again, dedicates significant segments of his article, Nitroglycerin in the Pomegranate, to discuss a complex link between the statue of a sphinx in a certain French novel and how Rizal used the word sphinx to refer to that spirit which he, Mr. Leeds summoned. But Joe Nickel in Secrets of the Sideshows yields the likeliest reason why Rizal referred to his undead creature as a sphinx. There was actually an illusion known as the Sphinx, which debuted in 1865 at London's Egyptian Hall. This is a description of how that trick proceeds. The magician entered carrying a small box, which he set on a three-legged table. The emptiness of that table underneath was plainly visible. Lowering the box's front, the magician revealed the head of Egyptian appearance, whose eyes he commanded to open. The Sphinx complied and then, following other commands, smiled and proceeded to give a speech. Finally, the magician closed the box and explained that the magical charm had expired. Then when he opened the box again, the head would be replaced by a heap of ashes. Now, the clever illusion depended on the table, which appeared to be empty underneath but actually concealed an accomplice. This was accomplished by the use of two mirrors underneath the table. They filled the space between the table's legs in such a way that they not only hid the accomplice but also reflected the carpeting on the side of the table. Thus, the audience members thought that they were seeing the carpet beneath the table. The actor then could insert his head into the box, withdraw it, and substitute a pile of ashes at the appropriate time. Rizal describes the trick from bluff to prestige in a similar fashion. However, Mr. Leeds' version of the Sphinx illusion has a number of clever innovations. The mirrors in his tables are concealable. They can slide beneath the floor, below the floor, and then rise when he places the box on the table. Mr. Leeds also allows members of his audience to examine the box, which is strange because that would likely reveal the boxes, the coal underneath the box that would allow the wherein the head would pop out. And then lastly, it appears unnecessary for Mr. Leeds to close the box when the talking head disaggregates into a pile of ashes. There is no description of a similarly advanced version of this Sphinx illusion. The Sphinx is only one variation of the classic speaking skull illusion, as I earlier mentioned. Rizal likely chose the Sphinx variety because it alludes to the ancient Egyptians, which was ruled for centuries by theocrats, much like Rizal's people. Indeed, the Sphinx's monologue sends chills down the spine of one friar who notes the similarities between the ghost story and that of Crisostomo Ibarra. However, the Sphinx monologue contains a statement that differentiates the rulers of ancient Egypt to the Castilian colonizers of the Philippines. The Sphinx describes the rulers of ancient Egypt as monopolizers of science. As will be shown in the following, science was hardly under the exclusive control of the aforedescribed elite. One character in the Philly says this line early in the novel. The men of science, do you know what they are? There you have in the province the Puente del Capricho, built by one of our brothers, which was not finished because the men of science, citing their own theories, criticized it as frail and unsafe. And look, it is a bridge that has withstood all the floods and earthquakes. This is where the word science first appears in the Philly, and these are declarations made by the friar Padre Salvi in a conversation with Benzai while they're aboard the steamship Tabo. The above is a tirade against the men of science issuing from a friar, a member of a community where men of cloth wield the authority of absolute monarchs. He condemns the men of science for their trust in theories that can naturally be falsified, which is decidedly unscientific thinking. Later, readers of the novel are introduced to another cleric who views science negatively, even though he is an instructor of physics and chemistry. Padre Emilion has considerable scientific knowledge, at least in comparison to most of his colleagues at the Royal and Pontifical University of Santo Tomas. Still, he has hardly convinced of the veracity of knowledge born from scientific inquiry. He would smile when speaking of the Earth's rotary and revolutionary movements around the sun. Thus, he forces his students to memorize the contents of science textbooks, though he makes little effort to ensure that they understand what they commit to memory. Students are not allowed to use the equipment in the university laboratory, as these are for display only. These two friars remind me of Edgar Allan Poe's or the king in Edgar Allan Poe's The Thousand and Second Tale of Scheherazade, in that these characters are dismissive of new scientific discoveries, adherence as they are to what they have long been familiar with. Indeed, both Salvi and the king exude a staunch belief in long-standing textualized myths, while both Milon and the king consider the notions of a ball-like earth ridiculous. Others who think of themselves as luminaries in their community seem to have some knowledge of natural laws, but appear to lack the capacity to think critically using such knowledge. The aforementioned Ben Zaib, who fancies himself the only thinking man in Manila, before the seance conducted by Mr. Leeds, declares that he knows the mechanics behind the apparatus. However, when he examines Mr. Leeds' table, he is unable to find what he is looking for reasons that were previously discussed. The self-declared intellectual elite are deficient in their appreciation of science or are unable to solve a quandary scientifically. What about the common folk? One representative of the lower classes in the novel is Sinong, the cochero. He asks Basilio, a university student, if the right foot of King Bernardo has been freed from bondage. He is among those who believe that only the folk hero's right foot remains chained. Sinong resolutely believes that King Bernardo will someday be completely freed from captivity in the cave of San Mateo to deliver the Indios from oppression. The cochero has even made plans regarding how he can be of service to the mythical king. In answer to Sinong's query regarding the state of Bernardo's bonds, Basilio can only smile while shrugging his shoulders. the reaction of a man taught to consider such beliefs as nonsense. Then there is Huli, the daughter of Cabezan Palace, initially a Marian devotee, who later decides to take her own fate, her fate from the hands of Mother Mary's son into her own hands. Huli allows herself to become the servant of the wealthy Hermana Penchang to earn money to ransom her father from bandits. Penchang is a woman who wholly believes that an infallible cure for stomach disorders is placing holy water on your navel while you are praying the Sanctus Deus. Penchang forces Huli to imbibe such beliefs, which Huli gamely agrees to, possibly because she is already a believer in miracles. Huli trusts that the Mother Mary will leave money underneath a statue of the Virgin if she prays for this to happen. However, Huli's faith in miracles is gradually lost. The money she prays for fails to materialize, for one. When her father is released by the bandits, she has to remain with Penchang to repay the cost of the release. Her father's lands are legally stolen by friars, which causes Cabezan Tales to become a tulisan, becoming the fearsome Matanglawin, armed with Simon's remarkable revolver. Even Basilio, the man to whom she has betrothed herself, is later in the novel incarcerated for supposedly engaging in subversive activities. With her belief in the possibility of divine intervention on her behalf shattered by such successive tragedies, she takes her own life. Basilio, as mentioned, Basilio initially has faith that is in a faith that is comparably fervent to those described previously, though the belief system he adheres to is without an anthropomorphic center. In the first of many one-on-one conversations with Simon, Basilio firmly believes that science is the primary aim of the most cultured nations. Within a few centuries, when humanity shall have been redeemed and enlightened, when there shall no longer be races, when there are no longer tyrants, nor slaves, colonies, nor empires, when one justice reigns and man becomes a civilization, a citizen of the world, only the cult of science will remain. The word patriotism will sound as fanaticism, and whosoever will take pride in patriotic virtues will surely be locked up as a dangerous maniac, as a disturber of the social harmony. These words remind me of the affirmation of science's supremacy over older bodies of knowledge in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. However, while Victor Frankenstein readily admits that belief systems invalidated by science are nevertheless contributory to the rise of science, Basilio seems to completely abhor the scientific, or the unscientific. For instance, Basilio describes the holy water in church fonts to be a source of diseases, contrary to the popular belief that they are curative. Simon agrees that science, or rather scientism, seems to be an ideal dominant ideology, as it can invalidate any socially constructed differentiation of humans based on science. However, Simon believes that there are necessary conditions to bring about the nationless utopia that Basilio envisions. Violent revolt, fueled by love of country, must first happen in countries victimized by oppressor nations. Many must die on the stakes so as to horrify the conscience of society, forcing society to grant freedom to the conscience of the individual. Simon is thus saying that nationalism can lead to transformative anarchy. He says this to convince Basilio that the only way for the younger man to achieve his aims is to become one of Simon's men. Basilio initially declines the offer, but later on, he agrees to become one of Simon's lieutenants because of certain tragedies that occur. Simon assigns Basilio to lead a revolt by bandits headed by Matanglawin as soon as the bomb explodes. With such advanced weapons, reserves of intellectual resources, can Simon's nefarious campaigns fail? As we all know, they do, as the novel shows. In his first attempt to launch a revolt without Basilio's assistance, Simon effectively calls the action off as he learns that Maria Clara is dead, plunging him into a grieving inactivity. His bomb also fails because of a fortuitous event. I don't suppose I need to reiterate this. You know how Isagani took the bomb, threw it outside. Yeah. Thus, the failures of Simon's schemes are attributable to the subordination of loftier desires for, well, romantic love. Padre Florentino, a Filipino clergyman, identifies another reason for Simon's lack of successes. According to the priest, Simon did not have the support of the inscrutable. The Heavenly Father will not give the glory of saving a country to him who has contributed to cause its ruin. Moreover, Florentino believes that why independence if the slaves of today will be the tyrants of tomorrow? Wenceslao Retana, that the above excerpt is evidence that Rizal was truly a great nationalist, but an enemy of separatism, and above all, an opponent of obtaining independence by force. Now, this is reflective of an erroneous belief that Simón categorically failed, or that his forces were soundly defeated. That same error can be seen in readings that say that only the anarchist solution was shown to be infeasible. Thus, does the Fili ultimately convey the lesson that even the most well-calculated technologically backed schemes can be outmaneuvered by a deus ex machina? This is a feasible interpretation, but hermeneutics aside, when one considers the existence of other potentially revolutionary voices in the novel, one realizes how Simón could have made higher the probability of successfully overthrowing the fictionalized colonial master. Among these novels are those of Sinong. As previously mentioned, he was waiting for King Bernardo to be released. Then there's also Florentino. Some say that Florentino's statement is an unequivocal non-support of violent revolution, but he is impliedly stating that a violent revolution that is sanctioned by the Heavenly Father, similar to the justification for the Crusades, will actually prosper. Now, these voices are hardly interact. These potential springs of revolution hardly interact. But these distinctive voices share in common one virtue that will allow them to stand in solidarity in the face of their colonial oppressors, that is nationalistic fervor, however vague that notion is. The notion of nation, which springs forth from which comes nationalism, is Western in origin, so many scholars assert. At the same time that nationalism was on the rise, industrial revolutions in the West were beginning to make science so common a facet of everyday life as to create societies that would eagerly consume science fiction in the years to come. Such fiction would invariably affirm the non-objectionability of giving the scientifically superior the right to dominate the scientifically inferior, which echoes the logic supporting the notions of manifest destiny and benevolent assimilation. The ideology that underlies such fiction is the same as the humanism based on scientism that Basilio initially adheres to. As shown above, the Fili implicitly admonishes a jump to such humanism. Nationalism is the one Western notion that Rizal wanted his contemporary countrymen to rally under, perhaps because of the deficiencies of humanism described above. Also because he knew that the believers in mythic monarchs or followers of earthly emissaries of Jesus Christ make up the majority of the local populace. Displacing these beliefs with scientism under a regime that stifles efforts to educate the masses is a task faced with insurmountable hindrances. In conclusion, if Simón ended up victorious, the Fili would likely be seen as a fantasy, dismissed the same way that science fiction is often dismissed, as the novel would be seen as spreading the message that a man with advanced weaponry is the key to the nation's salvation, that science alone can liberate Filipinos from oppression. In stopping short of producing what I think would have been the novel's or the country's first science fiction novel, Rizal is signaling his literary descendants to reflect on whether what they are writing amounts to tools for the reification of the domination of those whose guns shoot the farthest, or the support of the rule of those whose bombs kill the most.